don't come back with us and say you made me lose $10 million.
Do we need to put a disclaimer like a like a financial advice podcast?
Yeah, does, we should have. You make sure we have that disclaimer in the opening.
We do not leverage the farm on your whiskey brand based on this advice.
This is Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon, bringing to you the best in news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen, and I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman. We're not in the business of consulting to brands or distilleries, but a few months ago, we asked you to submit your questions about brand building, and we'll give our honest feedback, opinions, and advice. And in this episode, we take a few questions from you, and some are from entrepreneurs that are looking to start their own brand about what types of spirits to offer based on their location. Plus, our thoughts on using unconventional grains like oats, buckwheat, and rice. We also analyze labels, because how important is it to see stuff like rare, super premium, handcrafted, or even non-chill filtered on the label itself? Lastly, a brand begins to scale or potentially halts growth. So when is the right time to add a new state for distribution? If you want to ask questions like these about brand consultation or anything related, go ahead and send it to us. But please, nothing related to the distillation process because, we'll be honest, we're not chemical engineers. Shoot us a message at info@bourbonpursuit.com and we may read your question next time we record a show like this. With that, enjoy this week's episode. And now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Jeff Oberts, who writes me on fredminnick.com. I recently read a book on the history of bourbon. The author claimed that most information and the dates listed on bottles of bourbon are falsified. What is the purpose of falsifying the information, and would you agree with his comment? Well, Jeff, I think that might actually have been me. I think that was in my book, Bourbon Curious, and I said something like, bourbon labels rival political ads for bullshit per square inch. And the fact is, there's only a handful of things that are trusted information on a whiskey label. Everything else is fanciful. Wouldn't say falsified, but fanciful, meaning that it's just marketing. For example, small batch is a fanciful term. Small batch doesn't mean jack shit. You have this thought in your brain that it means like there's a handful of barrels going into a batch, when in reality, we're talking hundreds, even a thousand barrels could go into a batch, and they could call it small batch and get away with it. It's not a legal term. It is a fanciful term. Things like proof, age statements, those are actually governed. So an age statement is the age of the youngest barrel in the batch, and a proof is how the government taxes. That's how they base their percentage of taxes on a bottle of whiskey. So those things are verified by the government. But for the most part, like the backstories where you see like, my great grandpappy had this recipe, it's usually not true. They usually have the same recipe as MGP. So anything that feels marketing is just fanciful, unuseful terminology for really what's inside the whiskey. Another one would be like handcrafted. Just not a useful term. Like everything's handcrafted, you know? I mean, the blinds I'm looking at blocking the sun from my office right now, those are technically handcrafted, because handcrafted doesn't mean shit. As long as a human hand touched them at some point, that's handcrafted. So, Jeff, I would be curious to know if it was my book that you were reading and you didn't realize that I had written it. But, you know, that'd be funny. But I know other authors share that opinion and have written something similar in the past. But that's going to do it for this week's Above the Char. If you want to be like Jeff, hit me up on fredminnick.com. That's fredminnick.com. Click the contact button. Send me your idea. And if I like it, I'll read it on the air. Till next week, cheers.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixir's Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 a cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at WhiskeyAmbitions.com. It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in bourbon country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 0002703.
Welcome back, everybody. Another episode of Bourbon Pursuit coming at you. The whole team here, Kenny and Ryan.
Hello, hello. I'm and here again.
Mr. Fred Minnick himself.
What up? On up in here.
And we're coming back with a two-parter here. You know, we had actually done our first one talking about what is it like to give some free consultation advice. And there was a lot more questions that we didn't get to. And we were kind of looking at our list of topics and everybody said, let's just do another one of these. And I said, okay, let's do it. Why not? Let's just do a two-parter because there's a lot of interesting things in here and we can give our perspective on what people should do and how they should take their business. And also take this with a grain of salt. Don't come back with us and say, you made me lose $10 million.
Put a disclaimer, like a like a financial advice podcast.
Yeah, we should have. You make sure we have that disclaimer in the opening.
We do not leverage the farm on your whiskey brand based on this advice.
Yeah, we are only here to give as much opinions, as expert opinions as we can. Mm-hmm. But even at expert, we still give ourselves a yardstick, if you will. So you guys ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
Yeah, because this was a fun one last time. So let's kind of do the first one here. So this one is actually coming from overseas and it's coming from Alan. And he says, greetings, I'm in love with craftsmanship and I'm thinking of opening a small craft distillery around 1,000 to 3,000 bottles a year. I live on the countryside in Croatia and I have all the ingredients that I need for different kinds of spirits. Till now, I've just been making for my own personal needs. I do these things called mistletoe brandy, which is actually popular in my regional level and amongst different tourists. But it's also different than others that are in my region, and it's also very good. I was thinking that to be my flagship product, but I would also like to make other kinds of spirits, such as gin, whiskey, and vodka. Would you recommend me to start with or to focus on my particular mistletoe brandy or to make a bunch of different products?
Well, first off, 1,000 to 3,000 bottles is probably not going to be enough to pay for
anything
that you need. So you need to think a little bit bigger than that, first of all. But I mean, I would go with what you like best. What do you think you can, if you like mistletoe brandy, if you're passionate about mistletoe brandy? Yeah, I mean, you can make gin and vodka and whatever. You know, Fred loves vodka. He'll be a customer for life. If you can make mistletoe vodka, maybe mistletoe vodka, he'll like that. But no, I mean, find the product you're passionate about and that you're going to like put your name, you know, your name on, hang your hat on. Like, this is my thing. And I mean, you could, you know, to pay the bills, get a gin or contract to steal some stuff for people. But yeah, I mean, I'm more about being unique and having something that's a differentiator because there's a ton of everyday same products out there. They're just packaged differently. It's kind of boring to me. Do something exciting.
We also realize that you're talking to three guys that live in Kentucky.
Sure.
We're not in Croatia. I've never been to Croatia. I heard it's awesome. I heard it's beautiful.
Yeah, so it's definitely beautiful.
Definitely need to go and check it out. But
It's also one of those things that you've got to know your customer and you've got to know exactly what they want, because you could go, and this is just business in general. It's not even just whiskey. It's like you make something for the demand and whatever the product is there.
I don't know if mistletoe brandy's like just.
I know mistletoe brandy would do great at Christmas time.
Around here, but that's different. I mean, that's different when it becomes a cultural thing versus a timely thing. And if your mistletoe brandy is something that is unique to the area, that is something that tourists like, that is something that the locals like to drink. I mean, it's the same thing as getting, you know, grappa in Italy. Like it doesn't do well in America, but it does really well in Italy.
Yeah. So Croatia, I had to, cause it's pronounced a few different ways in different countries, but Rakija is their most common spirit there. And it is a brandy, often a plum or fig. And I wonder if what he's talking about is actually an infused rakija with mistletoe. That would be, I would say that, you know, that'd probably be a good fit. That country likes herbal, it likes aperitif kind of stuff. And, you know, Croatia's also got a lot of really great wines. And so, like, they're big in having wine with their food. In the spirits case, what they usually have, that it's customary there for them, is like to have it as an after dinner drink. But what's interesting about Croatia is like a lot of people make their own stuff at home. And so like,
and that's probably why he said, I'm making this. And that's
it's a legal thing there than it is here.
It's in the most countries, it's legal to distill your own stuff at home. And like people have like their own like homemade brandy recipes. In Portugal, they have like, they distill some unique stuff. In Greece, they will distill tree resin. Every country is different, but Croatia is kind of is really, really well known for rakija. And there's a couple brands that are in the market. I can't remember the name of the brand, but it's owned by Bill Gold from Faith No More. He's got a rakija on the market, but it's a... Everything that I've ever had, and I've had it in competition as well and blind, I mean, it is good sipping spirit. But it can, like, it does, like, make your belly feel good. Like, I mean, like, I remember, yeah, it's like a really
digestivo.
Good
digestivo or whatever. But yeah, so assuming that mistletoe brandy is a popular thing, is that something you should pursue versus having, you know, a wide portfolio of spirits?
I think the way to actually go about this is, I always say the data doesn't lie. Go and talk to a few different local shops and you figure out and you say, what are your best selling products? Like, what are your top 10? So you go to 5 or 10 shops in around your area and you figure out, okay, is it mistletoe brandy? Or is that just what you like? Just because what you like doesn't mean what everybody else likes. And so if gin or vodka or if some sort of locally crafted whiskey is actually a better seller, then you have to pivot. Like you have to figure out exactly what is the customer demand and what is that you're able to do. And I want to go back to what Ryan said earlier, that 1,000 to 3,000 bottles a year, that's not going to cut it. Like that, you're not going to, you'll be underwater if that's what you think that you're only going to be able to create.
Well, folks, you're also thinking, you're putting...
I'm looking at like actual, like, I'm not thinking US like 24-inch still time. I'm thinking like maybe a small copper pot still or something like that is probably what he's thinking of. But there's definitely a lot of different equipment that would be probably needed to be able to do this. And yeah, I don't think you're not going to get a break even at that.
Well, just do simple math. You say you got 3,000 bottles at $30 a bottle, you know, it's going to cost you probably $15 to $20 a bottle so you're going to make $30,000 a year on, you know, 3,000 bottles. I don't know. That just doesn't seem.
Don't apply U.S. business metrics here.
Well, I guess too, is this a hobby or a business?
Croatia's part of the European Union, and there's a lot of agricultural grants that he can get. There's whether for hobby or for whatever. And like, I would say, what's his name?
Alan.
Alan. I would say Alan. Take
great
a look.
Croatian name.
Take a look into what's happening in the department, the agricultural ministry of the European Union, to see like what's available there, because the European Union constantly has subsidies and things out there like that for people in agriculture, and that's what we're looking at here. And like you could start this thing overnight for nothing, for a legitimate business, and you could also immediately get picked up in European Union friendly, you know, liquor stores in France, Italy, wherever. Like, I mean, what you have in Croatia is access to an incredible drinking population. And I would say find where other Croatians live in the European Union, target those markets. But first, you got to figure out what you want to make. But
see, Croatians, this is why I'm glad Fred's on. I have no idea how European model works.
Yeah.
Well, I love that area of the world.
I do too. I love
seeing pictures of it.
Yeah. I've been to Italy, but I haven't been to.
But how many times have we heard Bill Belichick is from Croatia? His family's from Croatia. If you are a football fan, that's been pounded in your, you know, on ESPN
skull.
Over the years. And knowing some Croatians as well, they are very, very proud of their country. So I would say be proud of Croatia. Be proud of what you all make native to your country, which is Rakija or whatever brandy you're pursuing. And put Croatia big fat in the middle of the label, and you will attract your fellow countrymen all over.
What does mistletoe taste like, Fred? Do you know?
I would assume, and I've...
Didn't they kill dogs?
I have not eaten... First of all, I have never eaten mistletoe or tasted it, but I would assume it's going to be... I would assume it'd be a little like cedar or some kind of like a juniper citrusy or some kind of weird... Just like that.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And part of his question was also, you know, do you focus a product that is popular on a local level, or do you try to make it national, or do you focus on already established types of spirits, which is probably your gins, your rums, your whiskeys? Personally, I would look at it and say, is there already a big dog in your area? Or who are you competing with? Are you competing with somebody that else is putting out 3,000 bottles a year and they can't satisfy the demand in the market? Then you can be another player in that game. I look at it as a very analytical approach that, yes, you might be good, but is it better than what somebody else is already doing? Is there a big player? Is it something that is in hot demand? And then you can go ahead and sort of maneuver and kind of find that path.
Well, and also it's with every business or book. This is how I learned this process was through book proposals. If you are trying to create something to put out into the market and there's no competition, that's a bad sign, because if there's no competition, that means
nobody wants it anyway.
Nobody wants the category. And so you have to create something that that consumers want. And you know what? There's a reason why there's not a lot of French whiskeys. There's a reason why. And so anytime like a new French whiskey comes out, you know, people taste it, it gets its run in the whiskey circuit, and then it kind of like fades over time. France is cognac, Armagnac, Calvados, wine, champagne. Croatia is Rakija in like, you know, there's not really a lot of other things, you know, that's known. And so I think the market for Allen is to sing from the rooftops, Croatia. That's what I think the market is. And whatever he makes, whether he makes whiskey, plum brandy, vodka, if he puts Croatia on the label, I think it will be successful in other areas where Croatians are living. That's my opinion.
And that's how you scale. That's how you get it to different markets as well. So,
all right. Hope we helped.
There's also kind of it's a second part to his question, but I feel like it also kind of deserves its own sort of answer as we start getting into this, because it can apply to a bunch of different things, and it could apply to people that are just starting a whiskey brand or people that just care about labels. And he said also, as I'm very dedicated to the bottle and the label design, because it's a custom bottle and a label that I designed myself. Is this the right way to do it, or am I wasting money? And this kind of goes to the thing of like, do we just go something else that's just off the shelf?
Yeah, once again, if you're going custom, that's going to be money, and you're going to need more than 3,000 bottles to create that mold and, you know, create those custom designs and molds and presses and punches for your label. And so that's going to come at an extreme cost. And so you're just going to have to do simple math and say, yeah, if I want to go, I would also too look at what there's a ton of bottles available that are mass produced that, you know, they're common, but they're not common. And so, like, I would look there first to see how could I make my label. Because label design, you can get as custom as you want. It's not that crazy expensive.
You can put a label on anything.
Yeah, yeah. But bottle design, my God, you know, you get into the $30,000 to $40,000 just to get a mold made, you know, for that. And that's a sunk cost you got to recoup. That's a lot of bottles you got to recoup, you know. So I would try to look at, you know, what's available on the glass, say, how can we make this work? What can we do with the label to make it unique to us? And then if that still doesn't satisfy your need, look at what the custom is, but then you're going to have to look at your model and say, how do I recoup this cost in my bottles, and how many will I have to sell to recoup that down the line?
You know, you said the mold is just one part of the cost, because as soon as you start going down the path of a custom glass, and even for our brand, I would love, absolutely love to do a custom glass. The problem is that you have a bunch of front end work to do that. You have to hire the right person, the right designer that can go and how do you know who to talk to say, hey, I need custom glass. Like you don't talk to a graphic artist. Like there's somebody that's specialized in doing something like this, because they have to know how to talk to, you know, whatever the CAD drawing to be able to figure out what this is going to look like. They also have to be a designer. Like it's a long process that probably goes into it. And so even when you're going to go into the custom glass side of things, like you have to realize that when you want to do this, you have to be a scale company. You're not going to be messing around with 10, 12, 30,000 bottles a year. Like you want to be in the, you know, 500,000 bottles a year. Like that's probably where you need to start off if you're going to go the custom glass route, because you need that. You need to be able to put enough product out there that's going to, you know, pay for the mold. You know, you said $30,000. That's probably on the low end.
Yeah, I was just throwing a number out there.
I mean, I'm not going to say names, but there's a very ornate decanter that comes out every single year from a very large company, and I've heard that mold costs upward of $80,000 to $100,000. And so that is something that, you know, and it depends on the country, whether you're going to China, Mexico, or Italy to have this manufactured. That's all going to play into the cost of it as well. But for any brand that is just starting out, you know, you have different things. You've got Saver Glass that has a lot of cool bottles available, which I remember when we were starting to look through all our different manufacturers, and I started looking through Saver Glass. You can just Google them, they're online. And I was like, wait a minute. They have the Old Forester birthday bourbon bottle. That's not custom to Old Forester at all. Like anybody can go use that bottle. Like there's a lot of cool bottles that are out there on the market that you can get your hands on, and you can build a brand around it. And, you know, when you talk about the label, Ryan talked about the presses and being able to do foils and everything like that. But I think that's second to everything. You've got to find the glass first. You got to figure out what are you trying to do? What's the attention you're trying to grab? Do you just want to be another wine bottle on the shelf? Which we talked about, that's the cheapest way to ever do anything, is to have that standard wine bottle look. It looks nice because it's skinny, it's tall, it stands out, but you've also got to figure out how do you make your package look different than anybody else's too.
How do you elevate that wine bottle so it doesn't look like everyone else's?
I do think there are some rules that you have to follow if you're a new brand. Don't be too fat, don't be too tall, and make sure your brand and font is legible. And the least intelligent person in the room could read it, if they can read. And that's really, you know, when it comes to bottles, I'm as impressed with the original bottle that you all use for your Pursuit series as I am with the Old Fitzgerald decanter. Like bottle coolness does, outside of a handful, very rarely wow me, but I'm a curmudgeon at this point.
Well, ours was the original Parker's Heritage-esque kind of looking bottle. But that was one of the things when we started, it was, you know, look at the bottles on the shelves that are already there. Odds are you're not going to go and find a bottle that nobody else is using. Like they wouldn't have stock bottles if somebody wasn't using it already. So you've just got to look at all the different bottles on the shelf, go to a liquor store and see which one speaks to you. Is there something that has rounded shoulders? Is it tall? Is it too skinny? Is it whatever it is? And that's how you look at it.
I like the rule of not too fat. I hate wide bottles, like extra wide bottles. I'm like, oh, yeah. like
Old Forester birthday bourbon where you can't really like fit them on the shelves properly.
And it's we're talking about Europe here, whose bars are not huge, you know. These will often be like one row bars, and a restaurant will make a decision based on how big the bottle is if they've not tasted anything. There are, you know, probably 5,000 different limoncellos in Italy.
I love limoncello.
I do too. And they will make a decision based off of the bottle and how it fits on there, like a just a basic restaurant. They'll have five things on their shelf. Jack Daniels, some random sherry, a cognac, and something else, and a limoncello, and that'll be there. And then they have a wine cellar, so the wine will be different. But it's all about how it will fit on the shelf. So I would say do some homework, Alan. Go into some restaurants in the areas you want to compete and see what the bottles look like and take notes.
And so I'll have a follow-up question. This is not even scripted on here. I kind of want to ask you all.
But Alan influenced?
We were talking about, we didn't really touch on labels, but I think there's a good question we can talk about labels, because we just look at bourbon labels and we know exactly what legally has to be on there. Straight bourbon whiskey, Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey, blend of whiskey straights, proof and non-age dated, all this other kind of stuff. What is your thought on additional text? Like, how much additional text
can
you put on?
Fanciful stuff?
Fanciful, non-chill filtered, uncut, single barrel select. Like, how much stuff do you think that you should put on a label, and at what point does it become distracting? If you're anything like me, then you can't get enough about bourbon. And that's why I'm a subscriber to Bourbon Plus magazine. Bourbon Plus is a quarterly publication that tells the stories from the heart of bourbon. The farmers who grow the grain, the distillers who labor over the process, and the people, like you and me, who raise their glasses to celebrate it all. Subscribe to Bourbon Plus magazine today at bourbonplus.com, that's PLUS.com, and use code PURSUIT at checkout for $5 off your subscription. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/bourbon. But I think there's a good question we can talk about labels, because we just look at bourbon labels and we know exactly what legally has to be on there. Straight bourbon whiskey, Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey, blend of whiskey straights, proof and non-age dated, all this other kind of stuff. What is your thought on additional text? Like, how much additional text
can
you put on?
Fanciful stuff?
Fanciful, non-chill filtered, uncut, single barrel select. Like, how much stuff do you think that you should put on a label, and at what point does it become distracting?
It's tough. It depends on the brand. Like, me personally, I like the important information, but the least amount of information that gets the point across. I don't like a lot of clutter, but in the instance of like an older brand, like, I don't know, I love reading the stories on the back, and, you know, I love seeing all the, you know, it might be an older label design that they've stuck through, and I kind of like that. But to me, less is more. Keep it simple, stupid. But that's just my opinion.
I want information. I don't want so much words like handcrafted, forged, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I like age. Yeah. I like age statements. I like state of distillation, straight, bottled, and bond. You know, things that have meaning to it.
What about super rare and premium?
It means nothing to me, and it means nothing to, like, new consumers as well. Like, I mean, you talk to them, and like, they kind of gloss past that. There are some, like, words that will stand out to them. I think Cognac has done the best job of getting their marketing terminology down. It's VS, VSOP, XO, extra XO. And tequila is not far behind with Blanco, Reposado, Añejo, extra Añejo. And it's, you know, bourbon seems to be... You got one side that is all about, like, the clarity and transparency, and then you have the other side still clinging to the
clutter, maybe
very old special reserve. This,
Well, but that's a little bit different. That's like the brand name. I'm thinking of just like, let's just take the word non-chill filtered, for example. How important is it?
That is so important to an really educated. It's so important to an educated whiskey consumer, because like, you know, if something's non-chill filtered and you see flocking on it when it gets home, most consumers will think it's flawed. And flocking is when you see like these white clouds, and that's why, you know, chill filtration even was invented, to get rid of that, to prevent returns. And if you almost need that for your return purposes. Like, you could say, well, it says it's non-chill filtered right there on the bottle. And we're like, well, I don't know what that is.
The only reason I challenge that is because it seems that today almost every whiskey brand, whether it's, you know, the core staples of it, are all non-chill filtered already.
They could be carbon filters, something like that. But no, I think there's still a lot of chill filtration. You know, Buffalo Trace certainly does a lot. You know, they show it to you right there on the tour. They're proud of it. And I think chill filtration, as we learned on an episode recently, that it can have an impact on the flavor too. So that's an information piece to me.
So you think that should be maybe a requirement? If it's non-chill filtered, you should advertise it front or back? Any preference there?
I think that information needs to be on there. Now the real estate of where things need to be on the bottle, that's a completely different discussion.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but you know, I get caught up on the regulatory of what is bourbon and then finishes being called bourbons. I get caught up in that, and that's a discussion for another day. But anything that tells you what's inside the bottle is an A+ for me. Like, super rare, premium, handcrafted, small batch. Small batch is a word that means nothing, by the way. There's a lot of discussion on that in our various podcasts, and hell, emails will tell you more. But there's so many words that take up real estate that don't matter. And I'm looking at Willett over here. Like, Willett has some language, and then they hand write in the proof and they hand write in the age, you know, for their purple tops. And to me, that's great. They've developed their branding. It's like illustrious. They got that awesome font that they've had since forever. And, you know, it's a sexy bottle. It does the job, you know, and they don't oversell the super premiumization crap.
I always feel that if you have to say it's super premium, fine, and rare, it probably isn't. You know, because you don't have to say it. Like, it just should be, sort of thing. I don't know. That's the way I kind of look at something like
Happy
that.
Doesn't have that on their own thing.
No, and that's, but they also, that was also back in the days when they couldn't give that stuff away too. Like, I'm talking about, you know, somebody's coming out with a, you know, 15-year-old Canadian whiskey, and they have to put very old, fine, and rare, super premium, limited edition. Actually, the word limited edition, she put the word limited edition on something that is really a limited edition, sort of like one-time release.
Maybe just take it down to LE.
LTO.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would...
Well, I mean...
Or does that just come across in the news and it's going to be gone before people...
Well, I'm just thinking about like, you know, Four Roses small batch limited edition. I think I would rather say it on there because...
Actually say limited edition on it.
How do you decipher it from the... You know, the other one, but not looking at them two side by side, but I think they're similar bottles. It just, the other one says limited edition on it in cursive.
You know who does this is who, in terms of like, these are unique offerings. So when we talk about limited edition, we're essentially saying a unique offering like that one will not be repeated. Booker's does a great job. They used to just kind of be like random numbers. And now it's like 2022-1, and then they'll have it branded as like
some batch.
Pork chop this.
Yeah, Mama's Kitchen or Pork Chop or
Bubba and Buster.
They do a good job. And then they have some story on there too.
Yeah,
and
I like that. I like that approach from them.
I love the Booker's bottle. Love that. Like how they do it.
All right, so our next question comes from Nick, and he says, what's your opinion on the market potential of whiskeys made from unconventional grains, such as oat, sorghum, and buckwheat?
Well, sorghum, that one is up. So we need to be talking about cereal grains, and sorghum is a cousin to...
it'd be like rum, more of a rum,
yeah,
right?
And sorghum is, unfortunately, the federal government has accepted a distilled sorghum as a rum and a distilled sorghum as a whiskey. And there's actually historic evidence of sorghum whiskey being made in like Minnesota and Wisconsin back in the 1800s before there were definitions on what whiskey was. But sorghum, I think we have to go outside of that. So if we stick to cereal grains and we look at things like oats, triticale, rice, buckwheat, man.
Triticale, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, what's triticale?
I'm in agriculture.
Yeah, so triticale.
Or is it just kale? Is kale? No, I'm just kidding.
It's a hybrid. It's a hybrid grain. But what is it a hybrid grain of? It's of a...
We'll let you Google.
I'm going to Google
it. Ryan, I'll kind of get your opinion on this. Like the thought of unconventional grains, are these going to be, you know, novelties for whiskey enthusiasts, or is there a future interest in whiskeys beyond just traditional grains?
Wheat and rye. It's a hybrid of wheat and rye.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it tastes good, you know, you've always said it, you know, like, why are all whiskeys three grains? Why aren't they four grains? You know, and it seems like three grain is kind of the, you know, not that there can't be good four grains, and I think there's a place for them. Do I think they'll be as mainstream as, you know, the traditional three grain recipes or even two grain? I don't see that, but... And there's got to be a reason for that, why they didn't do that a long time ago. I mean,
it's ease of growth. I mean, like, so they, oats is the one grain that I think I could make a really strong case for, like, making a bigger impact in an American whiskey. And that oats just don't grow as much as they used to. But I think distilled buckwheat is like, I mean, it smells and tastes like, unless it's been aged for a certain amount of time, it's awful.
Here's the way I look at it. It's just going to be hard. I think there's a place for these unique grains. There's just no way they'll be on the scale of what corn is or wheat is or barley. Those are like three grains that help that you get, you know, there's massive amounts grown across the U.S. and they're so easy to come by, whereas these other grains are kind of, you know, grow in certain regions. They're not as, yields aren't as much and this and that. And so there's a place for them. I just don't think they'll, just from a supply standpoint, I don't think there's going to be a way to mass produce this.
Maybe rice on the mass production side.
Yeah, rice, of course, yes.
Maybe rice, but I don't... Yeah, if you're looking at mass scale, it'll never happen. But at smaller scales, look, I really like Penelope 4-grain. I really like Spirits of French Lick 4-grain. I think there's something there. I think it shows expressions of grain that have yet to have really been established. When Jim Beam was doing their experimental series with their harvest,
they had a brown rice one.
Brown rice, and they had triticale, and they were the first to really play around with that.
That latest Basil Hayden's a rice one, isn't it?
The toasted one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they've done a lot of things there, but I think this is where, when we talk about craft distillers, this is where they have the bigger distillers whipped.
Right.
Like, they have them beat, and it's not even close. It's because when you have these different oils in the fermenters and it comes down to distilling, you need to be really close to the distillation side and knowing when to make your cuts of heads and tails and having those hearts be juicy, full of all the essence of the grain, and then it's aged in a barrel. Like, they're very close to that. And the bigger distillers, I mean, they can create all the small micro stills they want. They are used to big, giant column distillation. And that is where I think the small distillers, if you find a grain, here's the problem. Getting to the point where you have a recipe that works and hits, that's the hard part. I thought Corsair did it triple smoke. I thought they nailed it with triple smoke, and this came out like 2010 to 2013. Everybody wanted it. It sold out as quick, but they kept doing experiments. And then people didn't want their additional experiments. They wanted triple smoke. And so that, you know, Corsair is a great case study of, like, they found their recipe, but they kept experimenting, which is the craft way. And I'm seeing with Spirits of French Lick too. I love what they do with a lot of their products, but they're still experimenting. Once you find your recipe that works, stick with it and make that. I think that's what you got to find, the grain that works for you in like that, that is unique, but that can be a part of the story that stands out. And you can buy enough oats or rice or whatever, stay away from sorghum, and make it work.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, the big column stills with the big boys, and they don't have the attention to, because it's all scaled, systemized, and this and that. You know, with Beam, they're, you know, they just installed that experimental craft distillery, you know, Freddie Nose head in, and I'm curious to see how that all evolves, you know, because they're doing the same thing, working with, you know, different grain mash bills and this and that. And so it's interesting to see them kind of get in that space. So maybe it is something that's going to appeal more, you know, widely than we think, but it's not going to ever be on a, because they had to install a smaller still to make it happen. They can't run it through their existing systems.
Yeah. The other thing I look at is when we talk about the 4 and 5 grain bourbons that did come to market, one to think of is, say, like Rabbit Hole's Boxer Grill, I think it was. It had some chocolate malt. It had a few other things.
Right.
But you see other ones that have oats in them. But these specialty grains are what? Less than 5% of the grain bill? So
often,
that has to show you something. Like, that has to either show you that there's either not enough product, or how much do you try to go against tradition and create something that could be a failed experiment down the line. You go with what works, and you try to figure that out too. If you do try to, you know, go through this whole idea of, well, I'm gonna bet the farm on making sure that I have a special buckwheat bourbon, right? Do you go and try to educate the consumers about it, or you just try to hide it? Because if it turns out so-so and it's not any better than the big guys, I don't think it's really worth your time to sit there and try and do mass education to say, this is what makes my bourbon better.
Yeah.
I think it's just one of those things that it's just part of what it is. It's just part of your grain bill. I don't think it's something that you should hang your hat on and make a thing that says, oh yeah, we do good buckwheat, we do great oat, we do great rice bourbon. I don't think that's the key that makes you a differentiator. I know there's other distilleries that say, like, oh, our corn is, you know, Blue Maize corn. Like, I don't give a
bloody,
shit.
It's gotta
be
butcher.
Good.
Yeah.
It's gotta be good. And if it's not good, then I don't care. I'd rather have something traditional. So don't tell me about how good your grain is if it's not any better than pretty much what's on the market.
There's also that aspect of, like, the consumer preferences are changing, and they're very open right now. And I think they're acceptive in, like, different kinds of ryes. Like, there's new breeds of ryes that are hitting the market, different types of wheats. But I don't think they are when it comes to corn. When it comes to bourbon, like, corn is kind of like, oh, that's great. You have Bloody Butcher corn.
Yeah, we don't need to know the variety.
You know, it's just like, you know, that, I think it's a little different. So I think it's like, if you are trying to make a bourbon, you can play around with the corn all day long. I'm just going to tell you that there's a reason why the big distillers have predominantly picked A2 yellow corn, because it works really, really well in column distillation. If you are doing pot still distillation, you can do some things that are different, that extract different higher percentages of oils, but you've got to make sure you don't veer too far off of what bourbon typically tastes like. You can definitely go on a different path, but you still got to have some of the tenets of a bourbon palate.
And I think a great brand that's done that is Chattanooga. You know,
oh, absolutely.
They like, has all the bourbon characteristics you want, but it's just
that maltiness. It's
just on the edge of, like, you know, something that's not bourbon, that it's kind of, you know, it's perfectly balanced between the two, of like something that's extremely unique, but also a great home base. So they masterfully created that product, you know, to really get bourbon consumers to latch onto it, but it's just different enough to where it's not so different or you just, like, totally dismiss it. It's got all the flavors you want, but enough difference that it makes it unique. So,
and I know this whole episode is about, like, tips for starting a brand, and I just have to say, Tim and the folks at Chattanooga, I mean, they had to sue for the right to have a distillery. They had to pass laws for the right to have a distillery. And I think, like, anybody who has the opportunity to start a brand now, I mean, there's a whole other aspect of regulations and things that you know, you're getting an opportunity now, because people have been busting their ass for the last 25 years for you to have that right to open a distillery. And you may be in a market that no longer allowed. And Chattanooga is a great example of someone who's laid the path, not just for the market of a new style of bourbon, which they have done with their high malt, but also that they have, you know, basically cleared a path for people who want to open distilleries in their area. That's another aspect of starting a brand.
That takes it to the the nines right there.
I'm not sure we can consult on that.
No, I just, but you know, Chattanooga. Yeah. But Chattanooga needs to have that love.
Story.
You know,
totally.
They
I mean, the shit they went through to get their brand going. It's amazing. It's yeah. Kudos to them.
I know.
What episode are they? If they want to, people want to go listen to them.
No, I have to go back and look. I can find it here in a minute. I'll start going to the next question. So the next is, as we start talking about brands have to get their product out to market. And so this was an anonymous question that came in, and it says, how does a new brand analyze when it's time to add a new state in which to sell? How deep should you go within one state before simply just widening the net with a new state?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something, you know, we're kind of going through too. And so, I mean, it all depends on how much product you have in the future, because you don't want to go to a new state if you're just going there one time, you know, because these distributors, they want to be, you know, they want to make money, but they also, they don't want to invest a ton of time in you if you can't deliver on the goods in the future. And so if you're like, I just want to go to the state just because it'd be fun one time, that's not a good way to go about it, because these distributors have a ton of money, ton of investment in you and trying to get your products on the shelves. And so if you don't have the product to sustain that, then I would avoid that. If you do, you just look at like, okay, say if I'm going to have, maybe I don't have the product now, but I have enough to sustain it, you know, in a few locations that I think it'll do well, but in the future I'll have a ton of product and I need to push it there, then I would explore other states and other markets. But two, if you're successful in one state and you know you're really just killing it, you don't want to pull product from people that are buying it just to go explore new territories. And that's what we're kind of dealing with here in Kentucky, is, you know, all of our local distilleries have started pulling product to go into these new markets, you know, in states that may not give a shit about them. You know, we hear all the time, you go to Montana or Idaho or Texas or this or that, and you're like, oh, well, we can find this. But you're like, well, hell, we're in the damn state. We can't even find it here. So that's, you got to draw that balance of like not pissing off the people that brought you to the dance. But
I think if you have to be, you have to be certain special to also be at the point where you're like, oh, Weller's cleared on the shelves. And if we think about a new brand, I also think about how stale can you get? Because if you are in your backyard and you're pushing and you're promoting your product there, you only have so many resources, unless all of a sudden you think like, oh, I can hire a sales force. I can go and have people dedicated to certain markets to have them help continually promote the brand. If you're just on your own, or you and somebody else or another partner or whatever it is, well, you have the opportunity to say, okay, well, we can hedge our bets in one area and let's go ahead and promote it. You have to see what that sell through is. If they're going to continually keep ordering and reordering and reordering, then you know what you're doing is well. However, if you just put it out there and you don't promote it or you don't try to get the sales, it sits there stale. How do you try to scale that? Well, all you're going to do is you say, okay, well, I'm going to open up another state so I can sell more product. But if you're not going to promote it, then the same thing's going to happen. And so all you're doing is you're casting that net out. But if you're not promoting it in those different markets, it's not going to sell. And so you're not going to have a happy distributor, because their product's not selling. They're not getting reorders from you. And you're going to continue this vicious cycle of, well, now I'm going to spread myself over 5 different states, but it's just sitting on shelves. I don't have any sort of promotion going towards it.
And two, you got to think, like, what's the competition like in that state? You might be killing it on the West Coast, but you want to come to Tennessee, Kentucky, the Southern states, and you're a West Coast brand. People aren't going to resonate with you as much. And it's like, why waste your time over here in the South where that's so competitive, you know, with bourbon, but you can be as unique on the West Coast. You kind of have to navigate that as well. It's like, even brands here, because the landscape is so competitive, they find pockets throughout the country that they can like capitalize on the market, because there is not as many brands available, and they can kind of get in there and be the name in that particular, or own that state that's not as competitive. So you got to just see what competition's like. Where are there places that I can make a name for myself where others aren't? Or do I want to own this specific area because I'm geographically close to it and whatnot? So a lot of factors.
I got a couple thoughts here. And, you know, one is how I have tracked, you know, audiences of bourbon interest, meaning people who will download a podcast, will watch a YouTube video, will read a book or buy a magazine. And there's probably legitimately 20 states that, you know, you can roll the dice and you have as good of a chance of getting a consumer just to rip it off the shelf without even looking you up, just because you're new on the shelf. You know, so there's 20 states that you can probably get, you know, get to that point. Most of them are in the southeast, Ohio, Illinois, parts of California, New York, obviously, and places like, you know, Connecticut. But I think you got to find out what are your core states of people that are in your email newsletter, people that are following you on social media. There's a lot of analytical tools that you can get for free. Find out where those states are and choose where you think you might have the greatest strength. The other option I would offer you is that we live in a wonderful time to be a new brand, in which you can develop a partnership with an online retailer that can legally sell your product and ship it to any number of states. One of those is Sealbox. Sealbox, which is Blake Ryber owns, and he's frequently on the Bourbon Roundtable. He works exclusively with craft brands trying to grow, you know, their presence. There are other ones. There's one called Mash and Grape.
Reserve Bar.
There's a bunch of them. There's a bunch of them out there. And so there are ways you can hit consumers and not actually, you know, focus. You can hit 22 states or something with one retailer. So, that's an option. But never underestimate anonymous your access to analytical tools within your social media.
Definitely agree. I think these are all great thoughts.
Yep.
With that, I think we're going to wrap it up for this one. This was another good session where we got to take your questions that are out there. If you have questions that you want to pose to us, you can go. The form is online. It's brbn.at/consult. So bourbon.at/consult. And we'd be happy to take these for a potentially future episode as well. I think these are fun because we get to look at a grab bag, maybe an ask me anything kind of scenario here. So it's really interesting to kind of hear your questions and what you like to see of brands. And there's actually other questions of people that want to get started on social media. They want to get started on different things, and we can take a lot of those different questions in different ways. So please keep the questions coming, and we'll bring these more episodes with you. But also make sure you follow us on all the socials. Follow our buddy Fred Minnick over here. Sign up to never miss an episode with our emailing list. And of course, always leave us a review and tell a friend about it. If you like these episodes and they're into bourbon, they're probably going to like them too. But with that, cheers, everybody. We'll see you next week.